Hello, I'm Liz Bobo, and this is Reflections on Life. It's hard for me to believe that it's now been almost 7 years since I left public office after 32 years in elected public office. And the legislature down in Annapolis is going through its seventh legislative session without me present. And things are going along just as if I was never there. We have some really good people representing us down in Annapolis. And I'm so grateful to them for the good job they're doing. So what I do to kind of keep some sort of order to my life is to keep six subjects in mind, and they are as if I'm walking around with a wooden frame around me that keeps some kind of structure to my life, because I have very, very few things that show up on my calendar on a regular basis, and that's by intention. So first, reflections on home in Colombia. It looks like we have survived, at least for the time being, the very, and I'm going to use the word acrimonious, I know it's a strong word, but the very acrimonious discussion about school districts and school boundary lines here in our county. That was a sad thing for me to observe, and I'm sure it was for many others, having had the blessing, I don't think that's too strong a word, of having known Jim Rouse and his absolute devotion and dedication to equality and integration of not only races, but religions and economic groups. So hopefully we're back on track to keeping respect for everyone, and particularly our kids in the schools. Reflections on Zach. My comments on Zach are that his sister Julia is now engaged to be married. Little Julia, 3 years younger than Zach, who sat by his bedside day in and day out at the end of his life, and is now 24 years old and engaged to be married. Her parents are so happy about it. Her grandparents are so happy about it. So we're seeing Zach through Julia these days. Reflections on Baltimore, my hometown. I'm reminded of how important it is, and there was a great editorial in one of my favorite magazines about the importance of local newspapers. They're dying off one by one across the country, and it is really important that we keep these newspapers alive and as healthy as possible. Yes, it's not the New York Times, it's not the Washington Post, it's not where we will get our major news about what's happening across the world, but what's going on in our own communities, how we're caring for our environment, how we're taking care of our kids, what are we doing in the arts to nourish our souls. So pay attention and please support our local newspapers. Reflections on public policy. I don't think I've ever been, although I've never met her, I don't think I have ever been aware of a more courageous woman than Maria, and I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce her name correctly, but the ambassador from the United States to the Ukraine. She is still speaking out after the incredibly direct, very poorly masked threats that she received from some people in our U.S. government. I have such deep respect for her dignity, for her knowledge, for her courage, and in Reflections on Public Policy, this is a thank you to this brave woman. Reflections on our planet beyond the United States. We're having fierce rains. We're used to having fierce rains in some of the parts of our planet. But now, down in the Gulf of Mexico, a degree of rain that we've never seen before, and in the Philippines. But it's not just in those Gulf territories now. It's up in New York State in the United States, the kind of rain that we've never seen before. And this is related, it has to be related to, the whole concept of climate change. And it's a reminder to us that we really have to pay close attention. So with that, we have Tim Latimer with us today. It's, I think, Tim's the second person who I've invited back for a second interview. He spoke about climate change and the whole concept of what's happening with what I as a layperson refer to as weather. And I've observed him in the, I think, 8 months since he was here. He's very active in our community, getting the word out through his scientific mind and his experience working on the science of climate, to get the word out that we have to wake up to this issue. It's not just an article in the paper. It's not just a spot on the evening news. It's something that's going to reach into and pervade every aspect of our lives in every country on this planet, no matter how wealthy the country may be. I mean, here in the United States, and I'm so grateful to be a citizen of the United States, and I don't mean in any way to denigrate our nation, but we sometimes think that we know it all, and we are going to be part of the effect of climate change every bit as much as the poorest country in the world. And it's not an issue that can necessarily be solved with more money. So I'm so grateful that Tim is out. This has not only been his career, it's not only been his profession, but it's pretty clear that it's his passion in his life. And I'm very grateful to know him. I'm grateful for what he's doing. He invited Lloyd and me to attend a colloquium at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. I think it was last week. I had been to one or two of them before because Lloyd worked at the Applied Physics Lab for the entire 50 years of his career, starting on issues on spacecrafts, but then converted over to working as an engineer. He does not have a PhD. He had master's in engineering, as an engineer on nuclear medicine issues, where Applied Physics Lab has made a huge contribution. So what I want to say, I don't want to tell you about what Tim had to say at this colloquium, but I want to tell you that the room was packed, and it was packed with young professionals, and maybe not professionals, but with young people, and you could see that they were just pretty much on the edge of their seats to hear what you had to say. And you make a good presentation, and I wanted to invite you back here so we could talk further about what the average citizen needs to understand about what is coming, to the extent that we can predict it, with climate change. So with that long and somewhat meandering introduction, I'm glad to have you back here, Tim.
Thank you, Liz. So really delighted and honored to be here. Thank you.
Well, good. Good. I'm glad. So pick up in the beginning wherever you want. I don't know if anything has changed in the last 7 months. I do see more about this issue in all forms of media and hear people talk about it over coffee or a glass of wine more than they used to. But tell us how things are going and how we're doing and what we need to learn.
Well, first of all, I would just say that there clearly is a lot more coverage in the mass media than there had been before. And I think, by and large, that's all to the good, because I think we can't act without really knowing what we're up against, right? And the first way to really engage on the issue, to my mind, really is to educate oneself and to help educate others. So really being able to understand what's happening in the world, whether it's the massive bushfires that we've seen happening in Australia, or the, you know, major storm events that you were talking about earlier. I mean, those are things that we have known for many years would be a consequence of climate change, that we are going to see, and we are already beginning to see, an increase in the frequency and intensity of major storm events, be they rainstorms or snowstorms, and an increase in the frequency and intensity, if you will, of drought events, as what we saw in the western part of the United States in recent years. So all those things are things that had been anticipated and are now beginning to manifest themselves. So if there's one thing I'd want to stress, it's that climate change is real and it's happening now, and we humans are the primary culprit. But also we have to understand that solutions are known. There are ways we can deal with this. And what we really need more than anything is political will to make the kinds of policy changes and other structural changes that need to happen in order for us to really avoid the worst consequences of climate change.
And that goes right to my next question that I had planned to ask based on what you said, and you've led me right into it. How are we doing? How is the federal government doing in our country on this issue? How are other major nations across the globe dealing with it?
Well, I would say really the locus of action in the United States has been, at least over the last 3 or so years, primarily been at the state and local level. When the president announced that the U.S. was going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, you know, a couple of things happened. Internationally, that was anticipated by most of the rest of the world because of the signals that he had sent during the campaign, but also we'd been down this path before, you know, 20-some years ago when the U.S. Bailed out of the Kyoto Protocol, which had been negotiated internationally back in the mid-1990s. You know, the U.S. is historically we are the number one emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, methane, and things like that that have a warming effect on the planet. But despite that, on now two occasions we have withdrawn from agreements that we ourselves negotiated with other countries around the world. So
may I just interject?
Yeah,
that?
Absolutely.
And we have not returned.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. In fact, because of the way the 2015 Paris Agreement was structured, we had to wait basically 3 years from the time the agreement went into effect for us to be able to submit our notification that we were going to withdraw. And then our withdrawal becomes effective 1 year later after we submit that notification. So last November, the U.S. did submit that notification formally to the United Nations that we are going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. So the effective date of our withdrawal is November 4th of 2020, which happens to be 1 day after Election Day.
Wow.
Many of the candidates, if not all of them, I think, in the Democratic primary have indicated that one of the first things, if not the first thing that they would do if they were to be elected, would be to rejoin the Paris Agreement. Now, that may be the sort of the starting point, but we have to go beyond that. And I think one of the things that we've seen in the last 3 years is a surge in focus and activity at the state and local level. Because what Paris did was it actually sent an important signal to the markets around the world and to state and local governments around the world, which is action has to be taken. And when it comes to making choices about energy systems, about our investments in infrastructure and those sorts of things, those are decisions fundamentally taken at local and state levels. So some 25 states have joined this effort, the U.S. Climate Alliance, for example, in which they're collaborating, cooperating on activities related to climate. Thousands of municipalities, cities, counties, private sector organizations have also stepped up and said, we are committed to achieving progress in reducing our emission of greenhouse gases at a level consistent with what the U.S. had agreed to in the Paris Agreement, because it's important that we cut our emissions. And in fact, what science is telling us, the scientific community has told us that really what we need to do by 2030 is cut in half, effectively, the level of greenhouse gas emissions that we were emitting, say, at around the period of 2017, and get that to zero by mid-century. That requires a pretty significant effort on the part of our economies. And as you know, economies don't turn around immediately, right? Lots of investments and things that were made in infrastructure that play out over time. But we've already begun to see electric utilities, for example, taking coal power plants, which emit a lot of greenhouse gases. We've seen them retire those plants early and bring online wind power and solar power installations. And it's driven by economics, because the price of electricity from wind and solar now is so much more competitive compared to the price of electricity coming from conventional coal plants. So just from the sheer economics of it, it's making sense for them to bring online cleaner energy. And the energy experts are projecting a significant amount of growth over the next decade in clean energy. But we can't be complacent about that. We do want to continue to push that because that's where the biggest changes really need to happen, is in our energy mix. But some of those are policy things, but there are things that people can do as individuals, right? One of the biggest things that people can do besides the energy choices they make relate to the consumer choices they make. If we move to a plant-based diet, not everybody is prepared to be a vegan or a vegetarian. Not everybody wants to give up meat entirely. But even if we cut it back significantly, starting out, say, with meatless Mondays and, you know, going from there, that can also have a real benefit because it's the raising of animals and the consumption of animals that also contributes to quite a bit of the greenhouse gas emissions, quite a bit of the deforestation that we've seen around the world. So those are some specific things that people can do. It's not just about recycling. It's not just about all the things that we might do that we think we might make us feel better, but it's things that actually can have a tangible effect. So I would just say that focusing our efforts at the state and local level and our individual actions can make a huge difference, and advocating for the significant policy changes that have to happen at state, local, and federal and international levels.
And it's an ongoing thing. We're not going to get there in my lifetime, certainly, and probably not in your lifetime. But it's something that will have to be big, big steps in the beginning, I would think, right. And then incorporating it into the way we lead our lives. How are we doing in our school curriculum? In our public schools? Are we teaching kids more about this as actually part of school in elementary or middle or high school or college? You get to choose your classes, but are we teaching this to?
I believe so. I mean, I've talked with educators, and my kids have just gone through in recent years the public school system here in Howard County. So I know that they get a lot of this information, but sometimes it might also depend on the lens through which the instructor is presenting the information, because many lay people will look at what's happening with the debate about climate, say, in mainstream media, where journalists will report on the conflict. You may have a report come out that is founded on decades of research and the work of thousands of scientists that have gone through peer-reviewed processes to publish their results. And they conclude that we have a significant problem with climate change and we have to really get our hands around it and deal with it now, that it's an emergency, basically, right? And on the other hand, you might have pundits or flacks for the industry who have been out there for many years casting doubt on the science. And they don't have to prove anything. All they have to do is cast doubt by throwing out a few facts and figures or numbers or charts and graphs that might look impressive but are not founded on any real peer-reviewed science. And those are tactics that the tobacco industry used decades ago to fight back against efforts to regulate the tobacco industry. Using some of the same scientists and some of the same tactics now, the fossil fuel industry has been engaged in a similar game. What that does is for the average person reading the press, they think, oh, there's a debate. There's a dispute about whether climate's even real. And therefore, I don't have to do anything. And when you talk about a problem that ultimately comes back to choices that we make as individuals, then anytime you can get an out, right? You get a free pass by saying, oh, well, there's nothing I need to do because the scientists are debating about this. Well, not anymore, not in the scientific community. The scientists are actually have a pretty overwhelming consensus that this is a significant problem. But getting those conclusions to sort of penetrate through the noise in the mass media is sometimes difficult. So I do think that's where educating oneself and then helping to educate others is really important, and understanding the sources of the information that you're seeing and calling on our journalists to do a better job of presenting the facts and not just playing up the conflict because they want to sell clicks or sell newspapers.
That's why I asked the question about the schools, because it seems to me, and I don't have this based on any documented figures or statistics at all, it's just the way my mind thinks about this, that we're going to need our kids to be teaching and educating us about this, because we are so immersed in the way we get our news, and we have so many choices. Yeah. We have choices to subscribe to fake news, as it has been termed by one of the artists in spinning fake news, as far as I'm concerned. And though there's so much for us to have to learn to change in our regular behavior.
Well, I do think that we have seen in recent years a real upsurge in awareness and activism on the part of young people. The Sunrise Movement, for example, has been very active in promoting recognition that we are in a climate emergency. I've seen them in Annapolis. I've seen them in Washington, D.C., leading the way. And I think that is a reflection of the education that the young people have been getting in recent years. The worry I have is that if the message to them is that the problem is so vast and overwhelming and there's nothing we can do about it, then it becomes easy for them to become disempowered. I've not seen that happen yet, maybe with a few individuals, but not as a movement. But it reminds me of what you and I both lived through decades ago when we faced the very real prospect of a nuclear holocaust, when we had the arms race and the Cold War. Many people felt overwhelmed by the enormity and the magnitude of the problem and a feeling that there's nothing that I as an individual can do to make a difference.
And also frozen by fear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that really does have an impact. And I think if people understand that, yes, it's a significant problem, but yes, we also know the solutions. We know the solutions are to stop burning fossil fuels, to stop cutting down the trees and the vegetation and emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and to get on with the task of adapting to the changes that we've already baked into the system. That those are choices that we can make, and those are public policy choices. And we, as voters and as consumers, we have the power. We can use our voice, we can use our vote, and we can use our dollars to influence the direction of policy taken by the public sector and the private sector. And there's, if I could, just mention a couple of other developments in recent months.
I would like that.
In that regard, the largest private equity investor in the world, BlackRock, recently, I think it was in January, announced that they are now putting climate at the center of their investment strategy.
And what, can I interrupt you for 1 minute? So what was their investment strategy before that? What are they shifting from? I'm just curious.
Well, they may have had their investments across a multitude of different sectors, right, of the economy. But I think what they're recognizing is two things. One, that there are tremendous opportunities in investments in things like clean energy, growth industry, right, where we see that, okay, if we build solar and wind power systems, then the fuel is free. This isn't like building coal or natural gas or other systems or nuclear that require a lot of investment in the actual fuel used to generate energy. When we're harnessing the sun and the wind, that energy source is free. All we're paying for is the technology and the distribution system. That's one.
That's all.
So there's, that's all.
That's all.
So there are some tremendous opportunities there. But I think the other critical aspect is recognizing the risks posed by climate change. And that as investors, they have an obligation to mitigate or manage those risks and be aware of them and basically bet on, you know, investments that will avoid or minimize those kinds of risks. So that's in the private sector. The other thing is, in recent years, the ratings agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, for example, have warned municipalities and states that they're looking more closely at how local communities are managing and mitigating the risks posed by climate change, and that if they don't see evidence that those communities are taking serious steps to change, to mitigate those changes or to adapt to climate change, that they could face a downgrade in their bond ratings, which is going to make it more costly to get financing for infrastructure and other sorts of things. The other thing is also in January at Davos, the World Economic Forum, which brings together business leaders from around the world, they published their annual risk perception report. And based on the surveys of thousands of business executives around the world, climate-related and environmental-related risks were seen as the top five risks over the short and long term that the business community is concerned about. So I think when the business investors and executives and others are waking up and seeing that the risks are real and we got to deal with them, that's when I think things can change. So I do like to see the activism from the young people. I think it's tremendous. But we, older folks, also need to be engaged. And we have experience that we can share with them, let them lead, give them our best advice, but I think also, help to make sure that they understand that this is a marathon, it's not a sprint, and change won't happen overnight.
I couldn't agree more that we can't leave it all to the young people. They're encouraging, and it's good to see what they're doing. But actually, you've said some things in the last couple of minutes that are very encouraging to me, and it just hadn't occurred to me. And when you said bond ratings, I thought, of course, of course. Right. So the bond rating agencies are actually looking at this already.
Absolutely.
And considering this.
Yeah. In fact, our county executive, Calvin Ball, shortly after he took office a little over a year ago, he went to New York and he came back and he said, you know, he had meetings with bond rating agencies and he said, you know, the first questions that they asked him were about climate change. And what is Howard County doing to deal with climate change?
That is very encouraging.
So I think that to me is also an important signal to public policymakers that it's the bond rating agencies and investors that are looking seriously at these things. You know, ultimately, I always like to try to sort of leave folks with a couple of thoughts. One is, as Victor Hugo once said, nothing is as powerful as an idea whose time has come. And we certainly are in that period now when we all have to band together to make change. The other quote that I like to cite is Margaret Mead, the American anthropologist, who said, never doubt that a group of concerned, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
Well, we are certainly going to need as much as any, and I don't even want to refer to this as an issue. This is so much more all-encompassing than an issue. Those quotes apply quite well, and it helps me get a better grasp myself, because my mind doesn't do real well along scientific lines, and I'm not doing that to knock myself. I have other skills that I need to learn that from other people like you. But to hear that the bond rate, that's a huge thing that I personally am getting out of this interview. And I read the post very closely from cover to cover. I still like to be able to read that newspaper and turn those pages. And I read everything I can get my hands on about climate change. And when it gets into the scientific areas, then I turn the page. But I find that extremely encouraging because it's a rather crass term, but money always has talked and it still does. So,
but we can harness the power of money, and we can harness the power of investment, and we can harness the power through things like a carbon fee and dividend program, which is gaining increased interest in places both in Annapolis and in Washington. So I think we can get there to use the power of the market to solve the problem that was created by failures in the market.
Right. Well, Tim, I'm so glad that you came back and spoke with me again. I'm so glad you invited Lloyd and me to the colloquium at the Applied Physics Lab. I know you're out working on this every day, and it is I can't overstate how grateful I am to you as a human being that you are working on this the way you are. And I think I've gotten to know you well enough to know you're putting your heart and soul into it. And the simple, I'm going to end by mentioning this one more time, that the bond rating agencies are speaking about this and about the economic risks, and we better get ahead of it because it's not just the air we breathe and the food we eat that's at risk. It's how much money we will have in our corporate pockets or our government pockets or our own pockets. So thank you again for what you're doing. Please let me know if there's anything I can do to be helping you. And while you're working hard on all this, be sure to take the time to love life. And I know you do, to love life and to enjoy it and to live it to the fullest.
Thank you so much, Liz. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks again for being here with us.
My pleasure.
This is Liz Bobo, and thank you for listening to Reflections on Life here at the Howard Community College Dragon Radio. We will be back with you again next month.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.
Whoa.